You bring my sister Lucy with you? Little Mrs. looked stumped. Then she said, Oh, her. She died a long time ago. She didn't see Phoebe's broken face, just her kitchen apron. I don't know what time you serve the midday meal, she said, but from now on it will be at 2. The slave quarters were busting seams. Every room taken, some sleeping on the floor. Aunt Sister and Phoebe yowled about the mouths to feed, and little Mrs. had me and Mama sewing new livery coats and house dresses for everybody. Welcome to the Grimkeys. She hadn't brought a seamstress with her, but she'd brought everybody else and their second cousin. We had a new butler, a laundress, little Mrs. personal chambermaid, a coachman, a footman, a groomsman, new help for the kitchen, the house, and the yard. Sobby got demoted back to the gardens with Skye, and Goodis, poor Goodis, he sat in the stable all day whittling sticks. Me and him even lost the little room where we still went sometimes to love each other. Now here in the cellar room, Mama didn't raise her head off the pillow. She didn't have use for little Mrs. She said, what she want with me? We got that big tea to put on today, and she wants the ribbons sewed on the napkins. She acts like you're the only one can do it. She's got me fixing the tables. Where's Skye? Skye's washing the front steps. Mama looked so tired. I knew the pains in her stomach had got worse, 'cause she'd picked at her food all week. She pushed herself up slow, so thin her body looked like a stem growing up from the mattress. Mama, you lay on back down. I'll get those ribbons done. You a good girl, Handful. You always was. The story quilt was folded on the foot of the bed where she liked to keep it close. She spread it open across her legs. It was July, a hot, sticky day, and for one tick of the clock, I wondered if she was feeling the cold you get toward the end. But then she turned the quilt till she found the first square. This is my granny mama when the stars fall and she gets sold away. I sat down next to her. She wasn't cold. She just wanted to tell the story on the quilt again. She loved to tell the story. She'd forgot about the ribbons, and there could be trouble for me lingering, but this was Mama, and this was the story. She went through the whole quilt, every square, taking her time on the ones she'd sewed since she was back. Her being taken away in the wagon by the guard, working the rice fields with a baby on her back, a man branding her shoulder with the left hand and hammering out her teeth with the right, running away under the moon. Finally, she came to the last square, the 15th one. It was me, Mama, and Skye with our arms woven together like a loop stitch. I got to my feet. Go back to sleep now. No, I'm coming. I'll be on up there in a while. Her eyes glowed like the paper lanterns we used to set out for the garden parties. I stood in the dining room, facing the window, stuffing big crystal horns with fruit, everything in the larder that wasn't rotten, when I spotted Mama shuffling towards the spirit tree at the back of the yard. She had the story quilt clutched round her shoulders. My hands came still. The way she slid one foot, rested, then slid the other one. When she reached the tree, she steadied her hand on the trunk and lowered herself to the ground. My heart started to beat strange. I didn't look to see if little Mrs. was near. I hurried out the back door, fast as I could, fast as the earth would pass beneath me. Mama? She lifted her face. The light had gone from her eyes. There was only the black wick now. I eased down beside her. Mama? It's all right. I come to get my spirit to take me. Her voice sounded far off inside her. I'm tired, Handful. I try not to be scared. I'll take care of you. Don't worry. We'll get you some rest. She smiled the saddest smile, letting me know she'd get her rest, but not the kind I hoped. I took hold of her hands. They were ice cold, little bird bones. She said it again. I'm tired. She wanted me to tell her it was all right, to get her spirit and go on, but I couldn't say it. I told her, "Course you're tired. You worked hard your whole life. That's all you did was work. Don't you remember me for that? Don't you remember I'm a slave and work hard? When you think of me, you say she never did belong to those people. She never belonged to nobody but herself." She closed her eyes. "You remember that." "I will, Mama." I pulled the quilt round her shoulders. High in the limbs, the crows cawed. The doves moaned. The wind bent down to lift her to the sky.
Sarah. We arrived at the meeting house in the swelter of an August morning, with every intention of going inside and sitting on the Negro pew. "Are we certain we want to do this?" I asked Nina. She halted on the browned grass, a harsh amber light falling out of the cloudless sky onto her face. "But you said the Negro pew was a barrier that must be broken." I had said that, just last night. It had seemed like a stirring idea then, but now, in the glare of day, it seemed less like breaking a barrier and more like a perilous lark. So far, the Arch Street members had put up with my anti-slavery statements, the way you abide swarming insects in the outdoors. You swat and ignore them the best you can. But this was altogether different. This was an act of rebellion, and it probably wouldn't help my long struggle to become a Quaker minister. The idea to sit on the Negro pew had come after reading The Liberator, an anti-slavery paper Nina and I had been smuggling home in our parcels and, once, folded inside Nina's bonnet. It was published by Mr. William Lloyd Garrison, possibly the most radical abolitionist in the country. I was sure if Catherine found a single copy in our rooms, she would promptly evict us. We kept them hidden beneath our mattresses, and I wondered now if we should go home and burn them. The truth was, none of this was safe. Pro-slavery mobs had been on a reign of terror all summer, and not in the South, but here, in the North. They'd been tossing abolitionist printing presses into the rivers and burning down free black and abolitionist homes, nearly 50 of them in Philadelphia alone. The violence had been a shock to me and Nina. It seemed geography was no safeguard at all. Being an abolitionist could get you attacked right on the streets, heckled, flogged, stoned, killed. Some abolitionists had bounties on their heads, and most everyone had gone into hiding. Standing there, seeing the disappointment on Nina's face, I wished for Lucretia. I wished she would appear next to me in her white organdy bonnet with her fearless eyes, but she and James had moved to another meeting, finding Arch Street too conservative. I'd thought to follow her until Catherine made it clear Nina and I would have to seek other lodging, and there were few, if any, suitable places two spinster sisters could board together. Sometimes I thought back to that day by the Delaware, when I'd told Lucretia I wouldn't look back, and I had carried on the best I could, but there were always compromises to be made. So many little concessions. "You don't have cold feet, do you?" Nina was saying. "Tell me you don't." I heard Israel's voice cut through the crowd, calling for Becky, and glancing up, I caught sight of his back disappearing into the meeting house. I stood a moment smelling the heat on the horse saddles, the stink of urine on the cobblestone. I always have cold feet, but come on, they won't stop me." She slid her arm through mine, and I could barely keep up with her as she towed me to the door, her chin raised in that defiant way she'd had since childhood. And for a second, I saw her at 14, sitting on the yellow settee before Reverend Gadsden with her chin yanked up just like this, refusing to be confirmed into St. Philip's. Soon after Nina had arrived in Philadelphia, the Quakers had made her a teacher in the infant school, a job she despised, Our requests for another assignment had been ignored. I believe they thought there was some pride to be knocked out of her by diapering babies. The eligible men, including Jane Bettelman's son, Edward, trampled over one another to assist her from the carriage, then loitered close by in case she dropped something they might retrieve. But she found them all tedious. When she turned 30 last winter, I began to quietly worry. Not that she was becoming another Aunt Amelia Jane like me. Indeed, I told her if she got Mrs. Bettelman for a mother-in-law, we would both have to drown ourselves in the river. No, my worry was that she would find herself 43 like me, and still burping Quaker babies. The Negro pew was in the low-slung spot beneath the stairs that led to the balcony. As usual, it was guarded by one of the men to ensure no white person sat on it by accident, and no colored person passed beyond it. Noticing Edward Bettelman was the guard today, I sighed. We were doomed, it seemed, to make fresh enemies of his family over and over. Sarah Mapps Douglas and her mother, Grace, sat on the bench in their Quaker dresses and bonnets. Typically the only Negroes among us, Sarah Mapps, close in age to Nina, was a teacher in the school for black children she'd founded, and her mother was a milliner. They were both known for their abolitionist leanings, but as we stepped toward them, I wondered for the first time if they would mind what Nina and I were about to do, if it would implicate them in any way. As the thought crossed my mind, I hesitated, and seeing me pause, no doubt worrying again about the temperature of my feet, Nina strode quickly to the bench and plopped down beside the older woman. I remember a blur of things happening at once. The exhale of surprise that left Mrs. Douglas's lips, Sarah Mapps turning to look at me, comprehending, Edward Bettelman lunging toward Nina, saying too loudly, "Not here! You can't sit here!" Ignoring him, Nina stared bravely ahead, while I slept beside Sarah Mapps. Edward turned to me.
"Miss Grimke, this is the Negro pew. You'll have to move."
"We're comfortable here," I said, noticing that entire rows of people nearby were twisting about to see the trouble. Edward departed, and in the quiet that followed, I heard the women take up their fans and the men clear their throats, and I hoped the disturbance would die down now. But across the room on the elders' bench, there was a spate of whispering, and then I saw Edward returning with his father. The four of us instinctively slid together on the bench.
"I ask you to respect the sanctity and tradition of the meeting, and remove yourselves from the pew," Mr. Bettelman said.
Mrs. Douglas began to breathe fast, and I was stabbed with fear that we'd put them in jeopardy. Belatedly, I recalled a free black woman who'd sat on a white pew at a wedding and had been forced to sweep the city streets. I gestured toward the two women.
"They're not part of..."
I'd almost said, "part of our dissidents," but stopped myself.
"They're not part of this."
"That's not so,"
Sarah Mapps said, glancing at her mother, then up at Mr. Bettelman.
"We are fully part of it. We sit here together, do we not?"
She slipped her hands into the folds of her skirt to hide the way they trembled, and I was filled with love and grief at the sight. He waited, and we didn't move.
"I'll ask one final time," he said.
He looked incredulous, incensed, certain of his righteousness, but he could hardly remove us forcibly. Could he?
Nina drew herself up, eyes blazing. "We shall not be moved, sir."
His face reddened. Turning to me, he spoke in a tightly coiled whisper.
"Heed me, Miss Grimke. Rein in your sister, and yourself as well."
As he left, I peered at Sarah Mapps and her mother, the way they grabbed hands and squeezed in relief, and then at Nina, at the small exultation on her face. She was braver than I. She always had been.
I cared too much for the opinion of others. She cared not a whit. I was cautious. She was brash. I was a thinker. She was a doer. I kindled fires. She spread them. And right then and ever after, I saw how cunning the fates had been. Nina was one wing. I was the other. Nina and I were summoned from our rooms by Catherine ringing the tea bell on what we thought was a restful September afternoon. She often rang the bell when a letter arrived for one of us, a meal was served, or she needed help with some household task. We plodded downstairs without a trace of wariness. And there they were, the elders sitting ramrod straight in the chairs in Catherine's parlor, a few left to stand along the wall, Israel among them. Catherine, the only woman, was grandly installed on the frumpy velvet wing chair. We had stumbled into the Inquisition. Neither of us had bothered to tuck up our hair. Mine hung in limp red tassels to my waist, while Nina's floated about her shoulders, all curls and corkscrews. It was improper for mixed company, but Catherine didn't send us back. She pursed her lips into something sour that passed for a smile and gestured us into the room. 3 weeks had passed since we'd first sat on the Negro bench and refused to get up, and except for Mr. Bettelman, no one had said an admonishing word to us. We'd returned to sit with Sarah Maps and Grace the following week, and then the next, and no effort had been made to stop us. I'd been lulled into thinking the elders had acquiesced to what we'd done. Apparently, I'd been wrong. We stood side by side waiting for someone to speak. The window panes burned with sunlight, baking the room to a kiln, and I felt a streak of cold sweat dart between my breasts. I'd tried to meet Israel's gaze, but he leaned back into the shadow from the cornice. Turning then to Catherine, I saw the newspaper lying on her lap. The Liberator. My stomach caught. Holding one corner between her thumb and forefinger, she lifted the paper as if it were a dead mouse she'd found in a trap and held by the tip of its tail. A letter on the front page of the most notorious anti-slavery paper in the country has come to our attention. She adjusted her glasses. The lenses were thick as the bottom of a bottle. Allow me to read aloud. 30 August, 1835. Respected friend. Nina gasped. Oh, Sarah, I didn't know it would be published. I squinted at her frantic eyes, trying to comprehend what she was saying. As it dawned on me, I tried to speak, yet nothing came but a spew of air. I had to strip the words like wallpaper. You wrote to Mr. Garrison? A chair scraped on the floor, and I saw Mr. Bettelman stride toward us. You want us to believe that you, the daughter of a slaveholding family, penned a letter to an agitator like William Lloyd Garrison, thinking he wouldn't publish it? It's exactly the sort of inflammatory material he spreads. She was not remorseful. She was defiant. Yes, perhaps I did think he would publish it, she said. Then to me, people are risking their lives for the cause of the slave, and we do nothing but sit on the Negro pew. I did what I had to do. It did feel, all of a sudden, that what she'd done was inevitable. Our lives would never go back to the way they'd been. She'd seen to it. And I both wanted to pull her into my arms and thank her, and to shake her. Their faces were all the same, grim and accusing, frowning through the glaze of light. All but Israel's. He stared at the floor as if he wished to be anywhere but here. As Catherine resumed reading, Nina fixed her eyes on the far wall, on some high, removed place above their heads. The letter was long and eloquent, and yes, highly flammable. If
persecution is the means by which we will accomplish emancipation, then I say let it come. For it is my deep, solemn, deliberate conviction that this is a cause worth dying for. Angelina Grimke.
Catherine folded the paper and laid it on the floor. News of her letter would reach Charleston, of course. Mother, Thomas, the entire family would read it with outrage and disgrace. She would never go home again. I wondered if she'd thought of that, how those words slammed shut whatever door was left there. Just then, Israel spoke from the back of the room, and I closed my eyes at the gentleness in his voice, the sudden kindness.
You are both our sisters. We love you as Christ loves you. We've come here only to bring you back into good standing with your Quaker brethren. You may still return to us in full repentance, as the prodigal son returned to his father. You must recant the letter or be expelled, Mr. Betterman said, terse and plain.
Expelled. The word hung like a small blade, almost visible in the brightness. This could not happen. I'd spent 13 years with the Quakers, 6 pursuing the ministry, the only profession left to me. I'd given up everything for it. Marriage, Israel, children. I hastened to speak before Nina. I knew what she would say, and then the blade would fall. Please, I know you're a merciful people.
Try and understand, Sarah. We looked the other way while you sat on the Negro pew, Catherine said. But it's gone too far now.
She laced her fingers beneath her chin, and her knuckles shone white.
And you have to consider, too, where you'll go if you don't recant. I care for you both, but naturally, you couldn't stay here.
Panic arched into my throat.
Is it so wrong to write a letter? Is it so wrong to put feet to our prayers?
Matters like this, they aren't the work of a woman's life, Israel said, stepping from the shadowed place along the wall. Surely you're not blind to that.
His voice was mired in hurt and frustration, the same tone he'd had when I turned down his proposal, and I knew he was speaking about more than the letter.
We have no choice. What you've done by declaring yourself in this manner is outside the bounds of Quakerism.
I reached for Nina's hand. It felt clammy and hot. I looked at Israel. Only Israel.
We cannot recant the letter.
I only wish I'd signed it too. Nina's hand tightened on mine, squeezing to the point of pain.
Handful. 4th of August. Dear Sarah, Mama passed on last month. She fell into a sleep under the oak tree and never roused. She stayed asleep 6 days before she died in her bed, me beside her and Sky too. Your mama paid for her to have a pine box. They put her in the slave burial ground on Pitt Street. Mrs. Letgoodis carried me and Sky over there in the carriage to see her resting place and say goodbye. Sky has turned 22 now and stands tall as a man. When we stood by the grave, I didn't come up to her shoulder. She sang the song the women on the plantation sing when they pound rice to leave on the graves. She said they put rice there to help the dead find their way back to Africa. Sky had a pocketful from the kitchen house, and she spread it over Mama while she sang. What came to me was the old song I made up when I was a girl. Cross the water, cross the sea, let them fishes carry me home. I sang that. Then I took the brass thimble, the one I loved from the time I was little, and I left it on top of her grave, so she'd have that part of me. Well, I wanted you to know. I guess she's at peace now.
I hope this letter makes it to you. If you write me, take care, because your sister Mary watches everything. The black jobber from her plantation named Hector is the butler now, and he does her spying. Your friend, Handful. I wrote Sarah's name and address on the front by the light of the candle, copying Mrs. Handwriting as close as I could manage. Mrs. Penship had fallen off so bad I could have set down any kind of lettering and passed it off for hers. I closed the letter with a drop of wax and pressed it with Mrs. Seal's stamp. I'd stole the stamp from her room. Let's say borrowed it. I planned to take it back before it was missed. The stationery, though, was just plain stolen. Across the room, Sky was sleeping, thrashing in the heat. I watched her arms search the spot on the mattress where Mama used to lay. Then I blew out the flame and watched the smoke tail away in the dark. Tomorrow I'd slip the letter in the batch going to the post and hope nobody took a hard look. Sky sang out in her sleep, sounded like Gullah, and I thought of the rice she'd sprinkle on Mama's grave trying to send her spirit to Africa. Africa. Wherever me and Sky were, that's the only place Mama would be.
Sarah. I woke each day to a sick, empty feeling. Catherine had given us until the first day of October to pack our things and leave, but we could find no one who'd take in two sisters expelled by the Quakers, and Lucretia's house was packed with children now. The streets had been flooded with hand flyers. They were tacked on light posts and buildings and strewn on the ground, the headlines screaming out in the salacious way these street rags did. Outrage! An abolitionist of the most revolting character is among you. Below that, Nina's letter to the Liberator was printed in full. Even the lowliest boarding houses wouldn't open their doors to us. I'd reached the borders of despair when a letter came with no return name or address on the envelope. 29 September, 1835. Dear Mrs. Grimke, if you are bold enough to sit with us on the Negro pew, perhaps you will find it in yourself to share our home until you find more suitable lodging. My mother and I have nothing to offer but a partially furnished attic, but it has a window, and the chimney runs through the middle of it and keeps it warm. It is yours if you would have it. We ask that you not speak of the arrangement to anyone, including your present landlord, Catherine Morris. We await you at 5 Lancaster Row. Yours in fellowship, Sarah Mapps Douglas. We departed our old life the next day, leaving no forwarding address and no goodbye, arriving by coach at a tiny brick house in a poor, mostly white neighborhood. There was a crooked wooden fence around the front with a chain on the gate, which necessitated us dragging our trunks to the back door. The attic was poorly lit and gauzy with cobwebs, and when a fire blazed below, the room filled with stultifying heat and smelled bitter with wood smoke. But we didn't complain. We had a roof. We had each other. We had friends in Sarah Mapps and Grace. Sarah Mapps was well educated, perhaps more than I, having attended the best Quaker academy for free blacks in the city. She would tell me that even as a child she'd known her only mission in life was to found a school for black children. "Few understand that kind of emphatic knowing," she said. "Most people, including my mother, feel I've sacrificed too much by not marrying and having children. But the pupils, they are my children." I understood far better than she realized. Like me, she loved books, keeping her precious volumes inside a chest in their small front sitting room. Each evening she read to her mother in her lovely sing-song voice, Milton, Byron, Austin, continuing long after Grace had fallen asleep in her chair. There were hats everywhere in various stages of construction, hanging on tree racks throughout the house, and if not actual hats, then sketches of hats scattered on tables and wedged into the frame of the mirror by the door. Grace made big, wild-feathered creations, which she sold to the shops. Creations that, as a Quaker, she never could have worn herself. Nina said she was living vicariously, but I think she simply possessed the urgings of an artist. Our first week in the attic, we cleaned. We swept out the dust and spiders and shined the window glass. We polished the two narrow bed frames, the table and chair, and the creaky rocker. Sarah Mapps brought up a hand-braided rug, bright quilts, an extra table, a lantern, and a small bookshelf where we set our books and journals. We tucked evergreen boughs under the eaves to scent the air, and hung our clothes on wall hooks. I placed my pewter inkstand on the extra table. By the second week, we were bored. Sarah Mapps had said we should be careful to conceal our comings and goings, that the neighbors would not tolerate racial mixing. But slipping out one day, we were spotted by a group of ruffian boys who pelted us with pebbles and slurs.
Amalgamators! Amalgamators!
The next day, the front of the house was egged. The third week, we became hermits. When November arrived, I began to pace the oval rug as I reread books and old letters, holding them as I walked, trying not to disappear into the melancholic place I'd visited since childhood. I felt as if I was fighting to hold my ground, that if I stepped off the rug, I would fall into my old abyss. Before we'd left Catherine's, a letter had arrived from Handful telling us of Charlotte's death. Every time I read it, so many times Nina had threatened to hide it from me, I thought of the promise I'd made to help Handful get free. It had plagued me my whole life, and now that Charlotte was gone, instead of releasing me, her death had somehow made the obligation more binding. I told myself I had tried. I had tried. How many times had I written Mother begging to purchase Handful in order to free her? She'd not even acknowledged my requests. Then one morning, while my sister used the last of our paints to capture the bare willow outside the window, and I walked my trenchant path on the rug, I suddenly stopped and gazed at the pewter inkstand. I stared at it for whole minutes. Everything was in shambles, and there was the inkstand.
Nina, do you remember how Mother would make us sit for hours and write apologies? Well, I'm going to write one. A true apology for the anti-slavery cause. You could write, too. We both could.
She stared at me, while everything I felt and knew offered itself up at once.
It's the South that must be reached, I said. We're Southerners. We know the slaveholders, you and I. We can speak to them. Not lecture them, but appeal to them.
Turning toward the window, she seemed to study the willow, and when she looked back, I saw the glint in her eyes.
We could write a pamphlet.
She rose, stepping into the quadrangle of light that lay on the floor from the window.
Mr. Garrison printed my letter. Perhaps he would print our pamphlet, too, and send it to all the cities in the South. But let's not address it to the slaveholders. They'll never listen to us.
Who then?
We'll write to the Southern clergy, and to the women. We'll set the preachers upon them, and their wives, and mothers, and daughters.
I wrote in bed on my lap desk, wrapped in a woolen shawl, while Nina bent over the small table in her old fur-lined bonnet. The entire attic ached with cold, and the scratch-scratch of our pens, and the whippoorwills already calling to each other in the gathering dark. All winter the chimney had steeped the attic with heat, and Nina would throw open the window to let in the icy air. We wrote sweltering, or we wrote shivering, but rarely in between. Our pamphlets were nearly finished. Mine, an epistle to the clergy of the southern states, and Nina's, an appeal to the Christian women of the south. She'd taken the women, and I the clergy, which I found ironic, considering I'd done so poorly with men and she so well. She insisted it would have been more ironic the other way around, her writing about God when she'd done so poorly with him. We'd set down every argument the South made for slavery, and refuted them all. I didn't stutter on the page. It was an ecstasy to write without hesitation, to write everything hidden inside of me, to write with the sort of audacity I wouldn't have found in person. I sometimes thought of Father as I wrote, and the brutal confession he'd made at the end.
"Do you think I don't abhor slavery? Do you think I don't know it was greed that kept me from following my conscience?"
But it was mostly Charlotte who haunted my pages. Below us in the kitchen, I heard Sarah Mapps and Grace feeding wood into the stove, an ornery old Rumford that coughed up clouds of smut. Soon we smelled vegetables boiling, onions, parsnips, beet tops, and we gathered our day's work and descended the ladder. Sarah Mapps turned from the stove as we entered, sheaves of smoke floating about her head.
"Do you have new pages for us?"
she asked, and her mother, who was pounding dough, stopped to hear our answer. "Sarah has brought down the last of hers," Nina said. "She wrote the final sentence today, and I expect to complete mine tomorrow." Sarah Mapps clapped her hands the way she might have done for the children in her class. Our habit was to gather in the sitting room after the meal, where Nina and I read our latest passages aloud to them. Grace sometimes grew so distressed at our eyewitness accounts of slavery, she would interrupt us with all sorts of outbursts.
"Such an abomination! Can't they see we are persons? There but for the grace of God!"
Finally, Sarah Mapps would fetch the millinery basket so her mother could distract herself by jabbing a needle into one of the hats she was making.
"A letter came for you today, Nina," Grace said, wiping dough from her hands and digging it from her apron.
Few people knew of our whereabouts, Mother and Thomas in Charleston, and I'd sent the address to Handful as well, though I'd not heard back from her. Among the Quakers, we'd informed no one but Lucretia, afraid that Sarah Mapps and Grace would suffer for consorting with us. The handwriting on the letter, however, belonged to none of them. I gazed over Nina's shoulder as she tore open the letter.
"It's from Mr. Garrison," Nina cried.
I'd forgotten. Nina had written him some weeks ago, describing our literary undertaking, and he'd responded with enthusiasm, asking us to submit our work when it was finished. I couldn't imagine what he might want.
21 March, 1836. Dear Miss Grimke, I have enclosed a letter to you from Elijah White in New York. Not knowing how to reach you, he entrusted the letter to me to forward. I think you will find it of utmost importance. I pray the monographs you and your sister are writing will reach me soon, and that you will both rise to the moment that is now upon you. God grant you courage. William Lloyd Garrison.
Nina looked up, her eyes searching mine, and they were filled with a kind of wonder. With a deep breath, she read the accompanying letter aloud.
2 March, 1836. Dear Miss Grimke, I write on behalf of the American Anti-Slavery Society, which is soon to commission and send forth 40 abolition agents to speak at gatherings across the free states, winning converts to our cause and rousing support. After reading your eloquent letter to the Liberator and observing the outcry and awe it has elicited, the Executive Committee is unanimous in its belief that your insight into the evils of slavery in the South and your impassioned voice will be an invaluable asset. We invite you to join us in this great moral endeavor, and your sister Sarah as well,
as we have learned of her sacrifice and staunch abolitionist views. We believe you may be more amenable to the mission if she accompanies you. If the two of you would consent to be our only female agents, we would have you speak to women in private parlors in New York. We would expect you the 16th of next September for 2 months of rigorous agent training under the direction of Theodore Weld, the great abolitionist orator. Your circuit of lectures will commence in December. We ask for your prayerful deliberation and your reply. Yours most sincerely, Elijah White, Secretary, AASS.
The four of us stared at one another for a moment with blank, astonished expressions, and then Nina threw her arms around me.
Sarah, it's all we could have hoped and more.
I could only stand there immobile while she clasped me. Sarah Mapp scooped a handful of flour from the bowl and tossed it over us like petals at a wedding, and their laughter rose into the steamy air.
Think of it! We're to be trained by Theodore Weld, Nina said.
He was the man who'd abolitionized Ohio. He was said to be demanding, fiercely principled, and uncompromising. I muddled through the meal and the reading, and when we slipped into bed, I was glad for the dark. I lay still and hoped Nina would think me asleep, but her voice came from her bed, two arm lengths away. I won't go to New York without you. I didn't say I wouldn't go. Of course I'll go. You've been so quiet. I don't know what to think.
I'm overjoyed. I am, Nina. It's just... I'll have to speak. To speak in the most public way. Among strangers. I'll have to use the voice in my throat, not the one on the page.
All evening I'd pictured how it would be, the moment when the words clotted on my tongue and the women in New York shifted in their chairs and stared at their laps.
You stood in meetings and spoke, Nina said. You didn't let your stutter stop you from trying to become a minister.
I stared at the black plank of rafter over my head and felt the truth and logic of that. And it came to me that what I feared most was not speaking. That fear was old and tired. What I feared was the immensity of it all. A female abolition agent traveling the country with a national mandate. I wanted to say, "Who am I to do this? A woman?" But that voice was not mine. It was Father's voice. It was Thomas's. It belonged to Israel, to Catherine, and to Mother. It belonged to the church in Charleston and the Quakers in Philadelphia. It would not, if I could help it, belong to me.
Handful. I was down near Adge's Wharf on an errand when the steamboat left the harbor, and it was something in this world. The paddle thundering, the smokestack blowing, and people lined up on the top deck waving handkerchiefs. I watched it till the spume settled on the water and the boat dropped over the last blue edge. Little Missus had sent me to get 2 bottles of import scotch, and I hurried now not to be late. I was the one who did most of her bidding these days. When she sent her plantation slaves to fetch something, they'd come back with the basket empty or still holding the note they were supposed to deliver. They didn't know the battery from Rag Square, and she'd make them go without supper if they were lucky. And if they weren't, it was 5 lashes from Hector. Last week, Sky made up a rhyme and sang it in the garden. Little Mrs. Mary, mean as a snake, little Mrs. Mary hit her with the rake. I told her, don't sing that 'cause Hector has ears to hear, but Sky couldn't get the song off her tongue. She'd ended up with the iron muzzle latched on her mouth. It was used for when a slave stole food, but it worked just as good for a slave mouthing off. It took 4 men to hold Sky down,
worked the prongs inside her mouth, and clamped the contraption at the back of her head. She screamed so loud I bit the side of my cheek till blood seeped and the copper taste filled my mouth. Skye couldn't eat or talk for 2 days. She slept sitting up so the iron wouldn't cut her face. And when she woke groaning, I worked a wet rag under the edge of the gag so she could suck the water. Coming out from the scotch store, I was thinking about the torn places on the sides of her mouth, how she hadn't sung a tune since all that happened. Then I heard shouts and smelled the smoke. A black billow was rising over the old exchange. The first thing that sprang in my head was Denmark, how the city was finally on fire like he wanted. I hitched up my skirt and jabbed the rabbit cane into the cobblestone, trying to make my leg go faster. The scotch bottles clanked in the basket, pain jarred to my hip. On the corner of Broad Street, I stopped in my tracks. What I thought was the city burning was a bonfire in front of the exchange. A mob circled around it, and the man from the post office was up on the steps throwing bundles of papers on the flames. Every time a packet landed, the cinders flew and the crowd roared. I didn't know what they were so stirred up about, and the last thing you want is to wait out in the middle of somebody else's trouble, but I knew little Mrs. doled out whippings for being late the same as she did for getting lost. I was weaving my way, keeping my head down, when I saw one of the papers they were trying to burn laying on the street, trampled underfoot, and I went over and picked it up. It was singed along the bottom. An epistle to the clergy of the Southern States by Sarah M. Grimke. I stood stock still. Sarah. Sarah M. Grimke. "Give that to me, nigger," a man said. He was old and bald and smelled sour in the summer heat. "Hand it over." I looked at his red, watering eyes and poked the booklet inside my pocket. This was Sarah's name, and these were her words inside. They could burn the rest of the papers, but they weren't burning this one. Come later this night, Skye and Goodis would come to my bed and say, "Handful, what was you thinking? You should have given that to him." But I did what I did. I didn't pay any heed to what he said. I turned my back and started walking off, getting away from his stink and his grabbing hand. He caught hold of the handle of my basket and gave it a jerk. I yanked back and he held on, swaying on his feet, saying, "What do you think? I'm gonna let you walk off with that." Then he looked down, that half-drunk fool, and saw the bottles of scotch in the basket. The best scotch in Charleston. And his gray tongue came out and wiped his lips. I said, "Here, you take the liquor and I'll take the booklet." And I slid the basket off my arm and left him holding it. I limped off, me and that sly rabbit on the cane disappearing in the crowd. I kept going past Market Street. The sun was dripping orange on the harbor, the green shadows falling off the garden walls. Up and down the street, the horses were hightailing home. I didn't hurry. I knew what was waiting on me. Near the Grimke house, I saw the steamboat landing and the whitewashed building with a sign over the door, Charleston Steamship Company. A man holding a pocket watch was locking the front door. When he left, I wandered down to the landing and sat behind the wood crates, watching the pelicans dive straight as blades. When I took the booklet from my pocket, little charred flakes came off in my hand. I had to work hard at some of the words. If one tripped me up, I stared at the letters, waiting for the meaning to show itself. And it would come, too, like pictures taking shape in the clouds. Respected friends, I address you as a repentant slaveholder of the South, one secure in the knowledge that the Negro is not chattel to be owned, but a person under God. Little Missus had me whipped by the light of the moon. When I showed up late at the gate without her import scotch or the money she gave me to buy it, she told Hector to take care of me. It was dark out. The black sky full of sharp edge
10-cut stars, and the moon so full Hector's shadow lay perfect on the ground. He had the bullwhip round up, hanging off his belt. I'd always taken my hope from Mama, and she was gone. He lashed my hands to a post on the kitchen house. The last time I was whipped was for learning to read. One lash, a taste of sugar, they said, and Tomfrey had tied me to this same post. This time, 10 lashes, the price to read Sarah's words. I waited with my back to Hector. I could see Goodis crouched in the shadows by the herb garden, and Skye hidden up next to the warming kitchen, the flash of her eyes like a small night animal. I let my eyelids fall shut on the world. What was it for, anyway? What was any of this for? The first strike came straight from the fire, a burning poker under my skin. I heard the cotton of my dress rip and felt the skin split. It knocked the legs from me. I cried out because I couldn't help it. Because my body was small without padding, I cried out to wake God from his slumber. The words in Sarah's book came fresh to me, a person under God. In my head, I saw the steamboat. I saw the paddle turning. Next day, I was measuring Little Missus for a dress, a walking costume made of silk taffeta, just what everybody needs, and her pretending nothing happened, being obliging. Handful, what do you think about this gold color? Is it too pale? Nobody sews like you do, Handful. When I stretched the measure tape from her waist to her ankle, the toe-up skin on my back pinched and pulled, and a trickle ran between my shoulders. Phoebe and Skye had laid brown paper soaked in molasses on my back to keep the raw places clean, but it didn't turn the pain sweet. Every step I took hurt. I slid my feet on the floor without picking them up. Little Missus stood on the fitting box and turned a circle. It made me think of the old globe in Master Grimke's study, the way it turned. The clapper went off on the front door, and we heard Hector's shoes slap down the hallway to the drawing room where Missus was taking tea. He called out, "Missus, the mayor's here. He's safe for you to come to the door." Mary stepped off the fitting box and stuck her head out to see what she could see. Missus was old now, her hair paper white, but she got round. I heard her cane fast tapping, and then her toady voice drifted into the room. "Mr. Hayne, this is an honor. Please come join me for tea." Like she caught the big fly. Little Missus started scrambling to get her shoes on. She and Missus were always bragging on the mayor. Mr. Robert Hayne walked on Charleston water. He was what they called a nullifier. "I'm afraid this isn't a social call, Mrs. Grimke. I'm here on official business regarding your daughters, Sarah and Angelina." Little Missus went still. She edged back to the doorway, one shoe on, one shoe off, and I eased over there too. "I regret to inform you that Sarah and Angelina are no longer welcome in the city. You should inform them if they return for a visit, they'll be arrested and imprisoned until another steamer can return them to the north. It's for their own welfare as much as the city's. Charleston is so enraged against them now, they would undoubtedly meet with violence if they showed their faces." It fell silent. The old bones of the house creaked round us. "Do you understand, madam?" the mayor said. "I understand perfectly. Now you should understand me. My daughters may hold unholy opinions, but they will not be treated with this sort of insult and indignity." The front door banged, the cane tapped, then Missus was standing in the doorway with her lip trembling. The measure tape slipped from my fingers. It curled on the floor by my foot. I wasn't likely to see Sarah ever again.
Sarah. Seated on the platform, I watched the faces in the audience grow more rapt as Nina spoke, the air crackling about their heads as if something was effervescing in it. It was our inaugural lecture, and we weren't tucked away in a parlor somewhere before 20 ladies with embroidery hoops on their laps, like the Anti-Slavery Society had first envisioned. We were here in a majestic hall in New York, with carved balconies and red velvet chairs filled to overflowing. All week the newspapers had railed against the unwholesome novelty of two sisters holding forth like Fanny Wrights. The streets had been papered with handbills admonishing women to stay home, and even the Anti-Slavery Society had grown nervous about moving the lecture to a public hall. They'd come close to canceling the whole thing and sending us back to the parlor. It was Theodore Weld who'd stood and castigated the society for their cowardice. They called him the Lion of the Tribe of Abolition, and for good reason. He could be quite forceful when he needed to.
"I defend these ladies' right to speak against slavery, anywhere and everywhere. It's supremely ridiculous for you to bully them from this great moment."
He had saved us. Nina swept back and forth across the stage, lifting her hands and sending her voice soaring into the balconies.
"We stand before you as Southern women, here to speak the terrible truth about slavery."
She'd splurged on a stylish, deep blue dress that set off her hair, and I couldn't help wondering what Mr. Weld would think if he could see her. Even though he'd led the training sessions for Nina and me and the 38 other agents, schooling us in the skills of oration, he'd never seemed sure how to advise the two of us. Should we stand motionless and speak softly as people expected of a woman, or gesture and project like a man?
"I leave it to you," he had told us.
He had taken what he called a brotherly interest in us, visiting us often at our lodgings. It was really Nina he'd taken an interest in, of course, and I doubted it was brotherly. She wouldn't admit it, but she was drawn to him, too. Before arriving in New York, I'd pictured Mr. Weld as a stern old man, but as it turned out, he was a young man, and as kindly as he was stern. 33 and unmarried, he was strikingly handsome, with thick brown, curling hair and biting blue eyes, and he was colorblind to the point he wore all sorts of funny, mismatched shades. We thought it endearing. I was fairly sure, however, it wasn't any of these qualities that attracted Nina. I suspected it was that saving speech of his. It was those five words. "I leave it to you."
"The female slaves are our sisters," Nina exclaimed and stretched her arms from her sides as if we were encompassed by a great host of them. "We must not abandon them."
It was the final line of her speech, and it was followed by a thunderclap in the hall, the women coming to their feet. As the hand clapping went on, heat washed up the sides of my neck. Now it was my turn. Having listened to me practice my speech, the society men had decided Nina would go first and I would follow, fearing if the order was reversed, few would persevere through my talk to hear her. Getting to my feet, I wondered if the words I planned to say were already retreating. When I stepped to the lectern, my legs felt squishy as a sponge. For a moment, I held on to the sides of the podium, overwhelmed by the realization that I, of all people, was standing here. I was gazing at a sea of waiting faces, and it occurred to me that after my tall, dazzling sister, I must have been a sight. Perhaps I was even a shock. I was short, middle-aged, and plain, with a tiny pair of spectacles on the end of my nose, and I still wore my old Quaker clothes. I was comfortable in them now. "I'm who I am," the thought made me smile, and everywhere I looked, the women smiled back, and I imagined they understood what I was thinking. I opened my mouth and the words fell out.
I spoke for several minutes before I looked at Nina as if to say, I'm not stammering. She nodded, her eyes wide and